My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Tatar, I'd like to welcome you to the teleclass Infection-Related Root Cause Analysis. A special welcome to you if this is your first teleclass experience. Our faculty today is Denise Murphy. Denise is the Chief Patient Safety and Quality Officer for Barnes Jewish Hospital at the Washington University Medical Center. What she has to say today has come out of, I dare say, a great many years of infection control experience, including 7 years as Director of Healthcare Epidemiology and Patient Safety for BJC Healthcare. That's one of the largest nonprofit healthcare organizations in the U.S. It's indeed an honor to have her with us this morning to give this presentation, and there are a lot of slides and a lot to say. We'll get right to it. Present the teleclass. Infection-Related Root Cause Analysis, a Primer for the ICP. From St. Louis, Missouri, it is my pleasure to present Denise Murphy. Denise.
Hi, everyone, and thank you so much for dialing in and joining our teleconference this afternoon. And I'd like to thank Paul for inviting me to cover this topic, which for ICPs is a very timely and important topic because we're all supposed to be doing root cause analysis around infection-related deaths that are unexpected or disabilities that occur from infections that are acquired as a result of being cared for in a healthcare institution. Just a little bit about the way I'll be presenting some of the slides that are in your packet. I will not spend time on, but I will mention the slide, and it will be for your reference after. I included everything I thought would be helpful in the packet, but for the sake of time, so that we can end on time and still have a little discussion around those things that may be more challenging for the ICP, there will be some slides that I skip over. If there's anything that you would like to see that I don't have, I'll try to work with Paul to get that posted and make it available. So let's get right into what is a root cause analysis, and we're going to start then on the fourth slide that's in your packet. And a root cause analysis is the process for identifying the basic or causal factors that underlie variation in performance. That's an important word, is variation, because if you have the same healthcare worker or the same team doing the same procedure over and over and over, it's going to be very common that there's some variation due to a lot of factors, some under the healthcare worker's control and some not. So certainly when you have a sentinel event and a root cause analysis, it's not always, and in fact usually not ever, solely a result of an individual's actions or that they were not caring or not qualified for the job, but usually an event occurs because there's many factors that come into play. So when we do a root cause analysis, we use this process to identify all of those areas of risk that led to a sentinel event, whether it did or didn't result in horrible harm to the patient. A sentinel event is defined, and I got this right from the Joint Commission, an unexpected occurrence that involves death or serious physical or psychological injury, or risk thereof. And that's where it gets gray. And that's where the discussions and the team effort to try and determine if something is a sentinel event is very important, certainly involving the patient's own physician or anyone that you have in a leadership role in your organization in infection control, hospital epidemiology, performance improvement, or risk management. Examples of sentinel events are death resulting from a med error or another treatment-related error, suicide of a patient while they are supposed to be receiving around-the-clock care, surgery that is performed on the wrong patient or the wrong body part, a hemolytic transfusion reaction involving administration of incompatible blood or blood products, and then finally, where it really relates to us, an infection-related death or permanent disability. The next couple of slides are from the Joint Commission website. If you wanted more references on sentinel event investigation, you could go to www.jcaho.org, and in the search engine, just type in sentinel event statistics. These are updated routinely and not always kept, you know, they're usually a couple months back in information because they're trying to keep up with organizations reporting sentinel events into them. And the first one is really for your information only, because it's a slide that depicts the number of reported sentinel events to the Joint Commission and what part of the whole those involve. So, for example, a patient's suicide out of several thousand events, 382 of them were patient suicides, and that made up only 15% of the reporting to the Joint. The you'll see on this slide, they don't even have infection-related deaths, and I think that leads to why the National Patient Safety Goal Number 7 is now requiring us to consider these as sentinel events if they're unexpected or if they result in permanent disability for the patient. If you go on to the next slide, sentinel event outcomes, you can see that most of the sentinel events that are reported do result in death to the patient, about 75% of the deaths. The next slide, I have an arrow pointing to sources for sentinel event identification, and many of them are reported by the organization's performance improvement or regulatory compliance team. But there is a group of people that work for the Joint Commission that actually do nothing but scan the media. They look through newspapers. They watch the news. They're constantly trying to find those sentinel events that may have occurred in organizations that led to harm but weren't reported to the Joint Commission. And what they do, just to speak to this a minute, because their reporting system is voluntary, a couple of things. One, you'll always see the numbers underreported because it's not a mandatory reporting system. But when they find something in the media or they get a complaint from a family, and that happens, you know, almost 9% of the time that a family or a patient will call into the Joint Commission about something that's occurred to them in a hospital, what they will do is they will sort of log that, and there, if it's very serious, there may be some contact if you're an accredited hospital, and they'll ask you about the root cause analysis and sentinel event investigation that you've done and ask some questions. But clearly, you can be sure that when you have a Joint Commission survey, this is an area that they will go right to, and they will make a patient tracer out of these types of issues that have been reported to them that are connected to your hospital. If you go to the next slide, you can see that most sentinel events that are reported do occur in general hospitals. And then the secondary most common setting is the psychiatric area and outpatient behavioral health areas and psychiatric units, of course, followed by the emergency department. In our organization, most of our sentinel events occur in the intensive care unit, in the obstetrics and gynecology area and newborn nursery, in the emergency department, and in the operating room. So that's ICU, ED, OR, and OB. And I think most hospitals would tell you that's where they see most of their sentinel events. Going on to the next slide, if you look at the root causes of sentinel events, and the way the Joint Commission finds this out is through your report and through a framework for reporting that Paul has shared with you. This is a document that I worked on with several of my colleagues on the APIC board to try and give ICPs a sense of how to use the framework and what the Joint Commission is looking for you to fill out in terms of documentation. There are sections that go through the root cause analysis and come up with what you believe was your primary root cause, and then the other things they refer to as contributing factors. So the primary root causes for sentinel events reported are communication, or a breakdown thereof, and a breakdown or inadequate orientation and training, or inadequate patient assessments. And then you'll see that that's followed by what they believe are inadequate staffing levels or availability of information. Looking at my organization, we've seen in our sentinel events that communication has been involved in 100% of these events, either as the primary root cause or a contributing factor. If you look at the next slide, the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research, our big national patient safety advocate, if you will, combs the literature and really looks into what are the root causes of patient safety events or medical errors. And they also document the communication problems and inadequate information flow are the most important things that we see involved when a patient is harmed. Human problems you may see, especially in the patient safety literature, identified more as human factors problems. Those factors may have something to do with a healthcare worker's stress level, whether or not they're exhausted, If they're working in an environment where they're overstimulated or they're constantly being distracted, human factors takes in looking at noise levels and lots of other areas. So human problems doesn't just mean that someone has made up their mind that they would intentionally disregard an important policy or procedure, or that they would go out to intentionally harm a patient, but often it involves system factors and the way we've set up the environment that the healthcare worker has to work in. So looking at the Joint Commission National Patient Safety Goal that came out in 2004, but we were supposed to have full compliance with this in 2005, so this is what we are living right now, is that we're supposed to have 100% compliance with current CDC hand hygiene guidelines, and to manage as sentinel events all identified cases of unanticipated death or major permanent loss of function that's associated with a healthcare-associated acquired infection. What I've tried to do is outline from discussions and from reading and from talking to lots of ICPs about what they feel the issues are. The issue number one is unanticipated death or permanent loss of function related to healthcare-associated infections has been grossly underreported to the Joint Commission because people are saying, well, why is this suddenly a mandatory thing that hospitals have to do? And this is the reason, is because there's been very, very little reporting to the Joint Commission over the years about deaths that occur related to infection, when in fact any unanticipated death or permanent loss of function should always be considered a sentinel event, whether the patient does or doesn't have a nosocomial infection in addition. Issue number two is that all sentinel events need to be investigated. They do not all have to be reported, but they do all have to be investigated. And sentinel events are investigated using a tool called root cause analysis. So when you send your paperwork into the Joint Commission, there's a framework that has to be filled in, a document, and that's what I sent out to Paul. And we've played with it and actually gone through an infection-related investigation. So you have that for your reference. So hence, this was what pushed goal number seven, was they were saying, I know there's people out there dying from infection that wasn't anticipated, and why aren't we hearing all of these? The last issue is that it's important to remember that in the National Patient Safety Goals require 100% compliance. When the state or joint commission comes into your organization for an accreditation or a licensing survey, they don't think that having 80 or 85% compliance is good enough. They will even argue you being in the high 90s, but they want to see constantly that you're taking some action in your organization to improve your compliance. Again, you don't have to report all of the sentinel events that are investigated, but you do have to investigate them, so you need to know how to find them. This is if you wanted to read a little bit more about why the Joint Commission made this patient safety goal. In January of 2003, in the sentinel event alert that was sent out to all hospitals, they talk about the fact that since the initiation of their database, they have only had about 10 infection-related reports since 1996, and of course knew that there were many more out there. Why the focus now? Moving on to the next slide. The Institute of Medicine has certainly done a lot to get our country involved with patient safety and starting to understand the impact of medical errors in the United States. There are many other studies that have been published that really put some meat to the Institute of Medicine's report, and those were the Harvard Medical Practice Study and the Colorado and Utah joint studies, where they looked at inpatient hospitalizations to see how many adverse events were occurring while a patient was hospitalized. And you can refer to this data later should you like to. But the next slide really talks about the proportion of adverse events. And you can see here that wound infections is the number two most common adverse event that's experienced by a hospitalized patient in this major study, where they looked at over 30,000 inpatient admissions. So this is why infection control has gotten so high on the national radar screen. It's good and bad news for us. It's kind of a mixed blessing in that we're required to do more reporting and more thorough investigating. Of course, it includes a lot more documentation and paperwork, but you can see that these big studies and the Institute of Medicine's work to raise consumers' awareness about the safety in hospitals has really put us on the national radar screen. Why include infection control in national patient safety goals? Well, when you look at the impact of infections on our country, the numbers are staggering, the costs are staggering, and the attributable mortality related to all infections is very frightening. Here I've just quoted the attributable mortality from Lyme-related bloodstream infections, but when you have up to a 25% mortality rate that's associated with the hospital-acquired infection, it's very, very frightening. Ventilator-associated pneumonia is even higher. In an ICU, the mortality rate can be as high as 60%. So certainly we need to include infections because they can be much more devastating than a patient fall or a medication error. So what do we as infection control professionals bring to the table and bring to the RCA process or the root cause analysis process? Well, we have the ability to investigate outbreaks and identify risk factors. That's what we do when we're doing our day-to-day work looking at infectious events. So we have a lot of experience in this area. And once you start doing a root cause analysis with a risk manager or a PI professional in your organization, you'll start to see that a lot of what we do is very similar. It involves data collection and organization and analysis, something that we're very good at. And we're very familiar with the use of standards and prevention guidelines. We have lots of experience in searching the literature. And when you're doing a root cause analysis and trying to make some decisions about process breakdown and where you can do some interventions to improve a process, the ability to search the literature and come up with some good evidence-based interventions is very important. ICPs are also experts at working with multidisciplinary teams. So what happens once you do identify a sentinel event? The Joint Commission says that you have 45 days after the event has occurred. Not 45 days after you debrief and you pull a team together and talk about what happened, but you have 45 days, if it's a true sentinel event, in which to report this to the Joint Commission, to report your root cause analysis to the Joint Commission, sending in your actual paper framework to them that is filled out. And that framework, again, Paul has made available to you. A multidisciplinary team should tackle each one of these content areas to help identify contributing factors, to identify what you believe is the root cause, and importantly, to not stop there, but to put effective control measures in place to reduce the risk of this occurring again. Please know that your risk management and performance improvement departments are experts at this. The Joint Commission doesn't say that the ICP has to conduct a root cause analysis. They just say that a root cause analysis needs to be done. So it's really important that you get the right people to the table and that you understand what you bring to the process, but you might not have the ability, at least as a novice, to lead the process. So how do you identify which healthcare-associated infections might be the cause of a sentinel event, or at least worth investigating to see if the infection was what led to the unanticipated death of the patient? What we do in our organization is work with medical records to identify all deaths on a monthly basis. We then take all of the hospital deaths and look into our infection control database to identify the potential healthcare-associated infection-related deaths. So we essentially match up the medical records list of hospital deaths with the names that we have in our database that we know of people during that time frame that had a nosocomial infection. Work with the hospital epidemiologist, or if you don't have one, your infection control committee chair, to review the chart and determine if the death or disability was unanticipated. Know the expected mortality rate that's associated with types of infections. So, for example, patients with VAP, since there's a highly anticipated mortality rate, might be hard to consider as an unanticipated death. But if you have a young person coming in for elective surgery with very few risk factors for SSI, that develop an SSI that weren't expected to die of any complications of surgery, then that SSI may in fact be the reason for their death, which was unanticipated, and a sentinel event investigation would have to be launched. So does everyone have the algorithm that I supplied to Paul that walks through what we do at Barnes Jewish Hospital? If you don't, I'll just once again kind of review what we do and then leave the algorithms for your referral at some future date. But we're essentially notified of all deaths and major disabilities that the medical records department picks up. We screen our databases for unanticipated deaths and disabilities, but we do exclude, or at least consider for exclusion, oncology patients, some non-oncology patients, but that are very, very severely ill. And then we also, for patients with that came into the organization with a disability, they are also excluded from our chart investigation. If the ICP determines that it's an anticipated, if the ICP gets through the chart and realizes that the patient doesn't have cancer and they didn't come in with a disability, then they review the chart to see if the event was unanticipated. And if it was, then they further go on to review the full chart and then sit with our MD hospital epidemiologist to actually look through the medical record to make a determination if this was an unanticipated death that resulted simply from infection. And when they do that, they have to look at all the patient's comorbidities and other risk factors that may have caused the death despite the fact that they had a hospital-acquired infection. So exclusion criteria that we consider at Barnes Jewish Hospital, therefore we would say automatically this was not a sentinel event related to an infection, would be any patient with a do not resuscitate status on admission, patients with advanced cancer or metastatic cancer, or a systemic cancer like a lymphoma or leukemia. We also exclude patients with severe heart disease, so that if they have CHF or end-stage cardiomyopathy, this certainly would not be an unanticipated death in a patient that's that ill. Not to say an infection wouldn't be a contributor or make a patient sicker that had severe heart disease, but it certainly couldn't be considered the root cause or the primary reason why the patient died. We also exclude patients with severe respiratory disease that have COPD, respiratory failure, or emphysema. We exclude patients that are in the terminal stage of a chronic illness like renal failure, patients in a hepatic coma, or patients with AIDS or other community-acquired infections like meningitis that are at high risk for death. We would not consider that hospital-associated. Patients in multi-organ failure, with severe trauma or massive injuries, or with an inoperable cerebral or aortic aneurysm, we would also not consider. Some of the department-specific exclusion criteria that we look at is when, of course, a patient is dead on arrival to an emergency department, if a patient's had CPR that was started in the field, or a massive intracranial hemorrhage or an MI. Those people automatically are not screened for infection being the possible cause of death. If a patient's had surgery with a ruptured aneurysm, or if it's an OB or pediatric patient. So for newborns with that die that were under 500 grams birth weight, we do not consider them. And we also do not screen newborns with congenital defects that are incompatible with life. When you look at some examples, it was helpful for our ICPs to look at some examples of what is major loss of function or permanent disability. Certainly a sternal reconstruction after a deep surgical SSI post-CABG that results in the patient's inability to return to work. This is clearly something that we might call permanent disability. Someone who has a permanent loss of hardware due to a deep surgical site infection that's after a total joint replacement, and that results in a permanent crippling of the patient or a permanent disability, especially if there is no ability to return to work. Now, here's what's confusing for us. You say, well, we have 45 days in which to report a sentinel event. Of course, when you find somebody and you find out later that a patient might have had a total joint replacement and they're in for their third or fourth admission and they finally just had to have the hardware removed and the patient is really unable and there's a designation that the patient's unable to walk again, what you would do in good faith is do a root cause analysis on it anyway. You may not be able to turn the framework into the Joint Commission under their 45-day time frame. But I think that doing the right thing for the patient is to get a small group together to do a sentinel event and root investigation and root cause analysis. And that way, if this is ever reported to the Joint Commission and you're contacted about it, you can say, infection control did not find out about this for quite some time after the patient lost their hardware and there was a determination made that this patient was permanently disabled. Or you could have found out from risk management as a result of a claim or a lawsuit. But it makes sense to see if there were any, and it's a good opportunity to see if there was any breakdown in a process or a system that the hospital's responsible for that could have led to this patient's infection to begin with. And it's a good way to start some performance improvement work with your surgical teams. So do the root cause analysis, even if it's post 45 days, and hang on to it and make sure that you keep a file with risk management of any sentinel event investigations that you are involved in. So I hope the algorithm and our process that you have available to you is helpful in the future if you ever have a sentinel event that you feel your team is willing to investigate. I do want to take a minute also to say that it's an overwhelming concept for ICPs with everything on their plate to try and be doing root cause analysis investigation. Again, I want to stress that most hospitals have departments that are experts at doing this. Take your concerns to them and tell them that you've spoken to your infection control physician leader, and you're very worried that this young, healthy person who developed an infection and ultimately died probably shouldn't have, and you'd like to do a more in-depth review, including some of the people involved on the service that did the surgery and cared for the patient, to see if there were any breakdowns in a process that the hospital can learn from and do better next time. Because we're so busy, sometimes we're afraid to call it and say, this to me does not look like it should have happened. So I had an ICP come to me a few weeks ago and say, one of our nurse manager's mothers died in the hospital. She was 90-some years old. And she died of a very serious infection that began with a nosocomial transmission of Clostridium difficile. This patient ended up in and out of the hospital several times and died of an Enterobacter sepsis. And I'm very uncomfortable, but I was so overwhelmed with everything I was doing that I didn't take this to the work group right away to say, do you think this is a sentinel event when we have someone die of a nosocomially transmitted organism when they're that old or they're that sick? This woman walked into the hospital and had gone on her walk that day and went swimming with her group of senior citizens the day before and was clearly in excellent shape and was in for an evaluation and some adjustment of her medications because she had severe arthritis. But there's no way that she should have died of an Enterobacter sepsis. So we took it to the Infection Control and the Patient Safety and Quality Committees and said, yes, even though this is sometime after the woman's death, we believe that doing a root cause analysis in good faith is important to do. And we actually included the woman's daughter in the interventions, which were she made a videotape that we took to patient care leadership, where she looks right into the camera and says, she sat in her mother's room and watched staff member after staff member come in that either weren't complying with contact isolation or were not complying with it properly, somebody that came in with a mask on and no gloves. So she looks into the camera and asks people to please take hospital infection control prevention measures, especially isolation and hand washing, very seriously because there's no reason why her mother, even though 90 years old, should have died of a hospital-acquired infection. So you can really get a lot out of investigating these, even though you don't have to be leading it and you're afraid that this is going to make more work for you. After you do one with risk management or performance improvement, I think you'll feel more comfortable and you won't be so afraid to make a determination that maybe this really shouldn't have happened and some of our processes should be evaluated. We're still going to start going through the steps of root cause analysis, and we have about 30 minutes left to our conference call. So I'm going to read through each one of these as we flip the slides, but I'm not going to spend as much time on some of them that I think are just kind of a no-brainer for those of you that have been doing hospital epidemiology. Before we get into the steps, we've got a cute cartoon there that says, "We never make mistakes in our clinic, Mr. Smith." And he says, "Well, my name is Mr. Krasinski." We have we're in a top 10 hospital at Barnes Jewish Hospital, and Washington University is the number 2 medical school in the country. And I can't tell you how many very common mistakes are made by incredibly talented, bright, and qualified clinicians on both our medical staff and our nursing staff. And again, if you think back to the earlier comment about human factors, our stress levels, our exhaustion levels, and the many things that distract us all the time will really put us at risk for making errors. So when you do a root cause analysis and you go through the steps, although it seems like a lengthy process, it's really very worth it to be able to identify those areas where there's a system set up that's really going to allow people to fail more easily than it's going to allow them to succeed. So step number one is to just sort of select a leader for your team and pull a multidisciplinary team of people together. And on the next slide, where it says it may be a newer, already existing team, sometimes in a department, if you have a sentinel event that involves orthopedic surgery, they may have a quality committee that meets, and those might be the people that would be best to pull together. But remember that it's important to include those individuals that were closest to the actual event that happened. So you wouldn't want to do a root cause analysis with a team of people that are used to looking at quality or that do peer review for orthopedic surgery, but not include the physician that whose patient it was, or someone critical to the team, like a physician's assistant, who might be the person who does a lot during the surgery. You do have to pick a respected and credible leader in order to get people to play and sit around and do flowcharts with you and really be willing to go through a process. But it's important to be very sensitive to the clinician's needs and their fears. They're very afraid of being sued. They have to know that what is said in that room will be kept confidential. We usually do not include a risk manager in our debriefings, or we include them sometimes in our debriefings, but not in our actual root cause analysis, because we want clinicians to feel safe with someone from performance improvement or patient safety that's facilitating the conversation, that all of the information is not going to end up in a claims document somewhere down the road. For the first team meeting, going to the next slide, it's important to establish some ground rules about how you'll make decisions, that everyone absolutely must be in attendance. And I would say for the most part, it takes 3 to 5 meetings to get a full root cause analysis done. Now think about this. If you know about this right away, let's say someone came in and had a CABG surgery or had an orthopedic procedure, and they were readmitted with a horrible infection and died. You would only have 45 days to get a root cause analysis submitted to the Joint Commission. So if you figure that it takes 4 to 5 meetings, and it's going to take closer to 5 if it's in an experienced facilitator, then you've got to get the meeting very often, and sometimes maybe even more than once a week. Talk about the meeting schedules and give people an opportunity to speak, and talk about how you'll handle disagreements. There's a lot of emotion around a sentinel event investigation. There has to be a very strong facilitator, which is why I really encourage you to talk to people in your organization who do this kind of work, because they know how to keep people on track and on target and how to deal with disagreements that come up during the investigation. Let people on the team know that there may be some assignments. Some assignments may mean they will have to do some investigation with you on looking at something in the chart or helping you interpret a particular set of notes that are going to be critical to figuring out what happened. Going to the next slide, step 2 in defining the problem, this is a lot of what we do during an outbreak investigation as well. We describe what happened, focused on what happened, but not why it happened. In these meetings, you're first going to talk about up front getting the facts and verbalizing very accurately and succinctly what happened. Mrs. Jones was a 55-year-old who underwent elective coronary artery bypass graft procedure. She had a cardiac arrest and she died on her third postoperative day. There were no signs of SSI. Sepsis was found, confirmed by blood cultures and autopsy, and the central line is suspected. So you have to be able to articulate what the problem is. Step 3 in the next slide goes on to studying the problem and collecting information that are related to the event or the possible event. This will be that you might have some statements from people who are directly or indirectly involved. There may be some observations. We've had ICPs go up, and as a result of a sentinel event going on, watch a couple procedures in the OR to see if there are process breakdowns up there. Physical evidence, if you have purulent secretions from a central venous catheter insertion site, or, you know, when you do outbreak investigations, one of the first things you do is call the lab and tell them that they have to hold on to any cultures while you're doing an investigation because that might be important information. And then you document any evidence on your framework that you have, such as pus noted at insertion site. If that's been found in a progress note, that gets transferred onto your sentinel event framework paper. Going on to the next slide, the information format, I'll just leave this here for you to refer to, but your risk managers can really help you determine what is or isn't something that you should be gathering during a sentinel event investigation, because remember, this is a horrible outcome, and the likelihood of there being a claim against the organization or a suit that comes down the road is certainly there. So we always want the risk managers giving us some advice on what's safe to hold on to or what's safe to collect in terms of evidence, if you will. Determining what happened sometimes involves flowcharting the sequence of events. First, you flowchart the actual sequence of events as they occurred, which is why it's very important that the people involved in the procedure or involved in the event are there. Then you flowchart the ideal sequence of events, what should have happened, and you highlight the differences. You flowchart the steps in any policies or procedures to see where you may have been missing something that your hospital's procedure says should be done, and then you certainly will compare the gaps. In creating a timeline of sentinel events, I won't speak through this, but I will just leave this here for your reference, but this is an example of what we mean when we say create a timeline. Talk about the event that occurred, the date and the time that it happened, and then any actions that were related. So the patient had a central line placed, you want to talk about when the patient was transferred to the CTICU. When the patient was transferred to a step-down unit, you talk about what happened, if there was any action. So in this particular case, the nurse that accepted the patient pulled the, the nurse that transferred the patient had pulled the line out prior to going to the step-down unit, and that's where she noted that there was pus at the site, but also noted that at that time the patient was still afebrile. So this is really starting to craft the scene of what happened. Going on to the next slide, step number 5, is where you identify contributing process factors. Why did the event occur? Now you're getting to all of the processes or things around the event that could have contributed to the patient's unanticipated death. Look at the processes that were involved in the event or could have led to it. You use some tools, and this is where PI will really help you in terms of brainstorming and creating affinity diagrams. So this is going around the table and asking people for their ideas. Someone's writing them on Post-its, and you start to just randomly post those on the wall. Then you start to cluster them. That's what an affinity diagram is called, to really look at if there's any common themes emerging. What are the steps in the process as it was designed, and which of these steps may have contributed to the sentinel event? The next slide talks about, and probably you've heard this when you do sentinel event investigation, the most important word is why. Why did the event occur? What is currently done to prevent failure at this particular step in a process? Was it done? If not, why not? If someone states, well, it wasn't done for this or that reason. It wasn't documented because the nurse that was involved in the OR is new. So then you say, well, why wasn't this nurse prepared? Well, I'm not sure if they went to orientation and training. Well, why not? Can we find out whether there were barriers to our new employees getting the training they need? So drilling down is really why a sentinel event investigation is so important. For the sake of time, I'm not going to go over the next two models, but they're in here for your reference, the Swiss cheese model of accident causation on the next slide, and then the blunt and sharp end models are very important models that are in the patient safety literature that essentially are saying anytime something occurs, there's a multitude of reasons why, and the holes in the Swiss cheese essentially have to line up so that not just one thing usually is a result of an accident, because we often have systems and processes and control measures in place that will catch something that fails. But when you have several of your controls in place and your double checks in place that fail as well, that's often when an accident will occur. And the thought behind the blunt end and sharp end model is often that the caregivers who are involved in accidents and who really have control of the patient for large periods of every day are often not involved in the making of policies and procedures and regulations and systems. So that's why we have people who are not the expert at caring for the patient going off in a conference room somewhere and developing a process or a procedure or system that really aren't aware of the complexities of the patient care or the little details that may lead to an accident that certainly weren't taken into account when a blanket policy was developed. Step number six, identifying other contributing factors. I'm going to take you to the next slide, because here's where the Joint Commission has given us some tools that in this particular case just give us some guidance for the questions we should be asking. But I've, on the left-hand side of the column, and this is very small, so I'm hoping that this is one of the larger, and actually if you have the handout electronically, you can blow this up. But for example, a death that might be related to a central venous catheter and a patient developing a BSI and then sepsis. When you look at areas of investigation, the behavioral assessment process, which and the physical assessment process or patient identification process, is really not going to have a lot to do with a patient getting a BSI like it would with a medication error or a wrong site surgery, for example. But those things that might impact infections are certainly staffing levels, orientation and training of the staff, whether the staff is competent or credentialed, especially in the case of the medical staff or an allied health professional or an advanced practice nurse, whether the staff is properly supervised, if there's good communication occurring among staff members, and if information is available and adequately flowing. So I've put the website on the bottom because they call this a root cause analysis matrix so that they'll help you know what to focus on when you're doing your root cause analysis. Step number six, when you're identifying contributing factors, a performance improvement tool that's used here is called the fishbone diagram. In this particular event, there was a Sharps injury in the operating room involved, and a team got together, and I just used this, although it wasn't a Sentinel event that harmed a patient. This was an employee that developed hepatitis C. In this particular case, you can see where up at the top of the fishbone, if you will, on the bones, you know, at the head of the fish essentially is the issue we're looking at, and that's a body substance exposure or a needle stick. But you can look at the primary areas of investigation or focus that are at the head of each one of the bones. And then the arms off of the fishbone are the things that are called contributing factors. And where you really want to put your efforts, because we have so much going on all the time and so few resources, is to look at the different themes that start to emerge. So when you're talking about care planning and orientation and competency and supervision, are you looking at an underlying deficit in leadership? Do you not have a good leader in that area who's supervising staff and making sure that everyone gets to orientation and training and shares information? And those are the areas where you'll see themes start to emerge. And in the next document, you can just see the same fishbone a little bit larger. And then going on to the next slide, we have an example of a fishbone that was done for a central venous catheter-related bloodstream infection. And I know it's hard to read on a handout, but certainly if you blow this up and print it, you can really very well read the areas where they've identified contributing factors that had to do with poor or improper technique for line insertion and contributing factors to why supplies get contaminated and so on and so forth. So enough about fishbones. Let's step quickly into number seven, met to measure, collect, and assess data. I'm not really going to spend a lot of time on this slide, only because infection control professionals spend a lot of time measuring and collecting data. But usually, if it's a sentinel event-related death, one of the things that a PI facilitator might ask the ICP for is, what are your usual infection rates for this particular ICU or this particular unit where this event occurred? So that's pretty much baseline data that ICPs may have. If not, you might have to get some help from a microbiology lab to help you look at how many central venous catheter-related BSIs occurred in that particular unit. So your role here might not be to collect information on a process like other team members, but instead to be handing over some baseline information. Going on to the next slide, step number 8, to design and implement some interim changes, you want to fix the low-hanging fruit and the things that you can do real quickly. And for other things, you want the PI facilitators to really make some suggestions back to leadership that a formal performance improvement team be put on some of the big, certainly the root cause of the event, but maybe also some of the contributing factors. One of the other things we're asked to do is to create a timeline or a Gantt chart. And again, on the next slide, you'll see the sample Gantt chart where you have to really look at what you're being asked to fix and a timeline in which you'll fix it, because the Joint Commission isn't too interested in you saying, well, we got together and formed a team and we said we'd fix this. They really force you to send in your timeline, and a Gantt chart is just the simplest way to do it, because they may be getting back to you to actually follow up and see if some of these things have been fixed. And again, I can't stress enough the importance of using PI and risk management personnel who are used to doing this. This talks about identifying which systems are involved, so the underlying causes for the root cause or the proximate cause, the immediate cause of it, it's very important understand what factors had to do with your root cause of this injury or event. Step number 9, we're still looking at root causes, and as I've been saying over and over, you'll usually identify multiple causes that you'll find when you start to do your fish bones and your flow charts and that sort of thing. They may include factors that are beyond the organization's control. So, for example, when you look at low staffing levels in the ICU, this has been well documented as contributing to high rates of bloodstream infections in intensive care units. But certainly the organization is not going to use a lot of their own resources to try and fix the national problem of nursing shortage. They're going to identify those areas where we have some control over fixing. So the this next slide is just some examples of what the proximate or root cause was on the left-hand side of the table, and on the right-hand side of the table, we have noted some of the underlying causes for the root cause. The 5 rules of causation on the next slide from David Marks, I'm not going to read all of these, but I do want to just say that the causal statements clearly show a cause and effect relationship. When we do outbreak investigations, we know that we can't always show an absolute cause and effect relationship, but often what we're able to show is associations, and that's sort of what you end up with root cause analysis as well. But most human errors, because we do believe that that most accidents do not occur because someone was intentionally trying to cause an error, but most human errors will have a preceding cause. So the reason why you pull everybody together to do all this work is to try and get at underlying causes, why these things are happening and why our staff are put at risk, actually, to make a major mistake. Pruning the list of root causes is really just asking 3 questions. Every time you come up with something that you think could be the root cause, you'll ask, would the problem have occurred if cause number 1 wasn't present? Will the problem recur due to the same causal factor if cause number 1 is corrected or eliminated? Could you still have the same type of error? And will correction or elimination of the cause lead to a similar event, if not the same event? If the answer to any of these questions is no, then you do have the root cause. If the answer to the questions is yes, then you might have contributing causes. And I've just put on the next slide a cute little slide that does kind of demonstrate what we're talking about here. You can see that the patient is blue, and the doctor is asking the nurse to to turn up the oxygen because the patient's blue, but you can see he's standing on the tubing. So when you ask the types of questions to determine whether or not the doctor was the root cause of the problem, you'd say, well, what if the tubing was on the other side of the bed? Could the problem still occur? Yes, it could, because the doctor could be over that side of the bed and step on the tube as well. What if the tubing was up off the floor? Could the same problem occur? Probably not. But could a different problem occur if the tubing was up over the bed? Absolutely. A nurse hanging an IV could get tangled in oxygen tubing. What if the doctor paid more attention to the environment? Well, I think the answer is that you have your root cause, which is a doctor not paying attention. But the contributing causes are things that we can fix about the system, and that is to find a better way to have the oxygen tubing set up in the room so that no one can come in and make that same mistake. So confirming the root causes, you do this by looking at the literature to see if things have been reported like this before, but you want to take a systems approach and not blame individuals at each step of the investigation. Error prevention strategies and mistake proofing are very important, and the root cause analysis team at this point, when they find their root cause, start to come up with strategies to prevent this from occurring again. A failure mode and effect analysis is a complex part of the RCA, and actually there could be an entire talk just on FEMA, but this is where you look at the steps in the process and you try and identify each step of the process, and this is where, you know, sort of the ideal process, predict where there's risk still involved, where there may be some failure or there may be other accidents that occur, and you keep redesigning a process until you can eliminate at least most of the risk that you can see. A FEMA will help you determine the severity of the potential cause of an error, and you score a FEMA by looking at whether or not, you know, the severity of the incident. Was it catastrophic? Was it major? Was it moderate or minor? And now we're kind of getting into details that a PI or a risk management expert would really be more responsible for than the ICP. So let's skip over the next couple of slides about FEMA, because, again, this is not supposed to be around FEMA, but more so just looking at what the role of an ICP is. But you can see some information in here about how a FEMA is scored, and it helps you just determine when you identify lots of areas where you could have a potential failure, but you have limited resources. These are scored so that you can use your limited resources on what they believe are your highest risks. So we'll jump a couple of more slides to the slide on designing a system to absorb errors. One of the things we want to try and do is standardize procedures as much as we can and reduce variation. And then look at our training. Are we just retraining people without seeing if they're competent and doing some follow-up competency assessments? And this is a big thing that you see as root cause pretty often is orientation and training, but often that there's no follow-up and testing of competency that's ongoing. And then create a safe reporting environment where people aren't scared to death to come forward and report where they see that there's risk because they're afraid that there'll be some retaliation. So the next few steps in the root cause analysis are all around formulating improvement actions. You want to direct your improvements or your performance improvement work around steps at the process that you know contain some risk. And the tools that you use are tools that the performance improvement specialist can walk you through, and I mentioned some of these earlier on, and have another sample here of a fishbone diagram from the University of Kentucky, where they were looking at how to prevent healthcare-associated pneumonia. And you can see that they have transmission prevention, staffing variances, patients on ventilators, and other areas where they wanted to really sort of map out these processes so that when they did some performance improvement, they could pick out particular steps that they would work on in order of priorities. Evaluate proposed improvements, and again, this is something that performance improvement would really be responsible for, but they may ask infection control professionals to be on the PI team and bring their expertise to the performance improvement work. The selected improvement actions, again, should just address first and foremost the root cause of the event that occurred, and then look down at some of the contributing causes as you start to move forward with your PI work. I can tell you that the Joint Commission will hold you accountable, though, for showing that you've put a process improvement in place to identify the particular root cause. They don't get too involved in telling you what it needs to be. They let the hospital make that decision, but they will make sure that you have some metrics to determine whether or not your process improvement is successful. So steps number 15 and 16 really are talking about your accountability for the action plan and making sure that it's followed up on. When the root cause analysis team finishes their work and moves into performance improvement, the infection control professional may have some to-do work and some things that they can bring their expertise on, but the leader of the root cause analysis is really the predominant person responsible for the action plan, and usually that would not be the ICP, but somebody from the unit or the service where the event occurred that was selected as the leader for the root cause analysis. So let's jump through the next couple of slides. Step number 17 is all about performance improvement and what kind of tools are used or methods are used to do PI, developing measures of effectiveness. You can't turn in any type of framework with an action plan to the Joint Commission in that 45-day period that doesn't talk about your metrics. They want to see what are your measures of effectiveness. So, for example, if you've identified in the case of someone becoming septic from a central line and you've identified that the root cause was inadequate house staff training on insertion of lines, they want to see two things. They want to see the process measure, and that is, what are you doing to improve the training of house staff and how often do you do it? And number two, they want to know that you're tracking all of your catheter-related BSIs, but particularly in the areas where house staff are doing them, that there's a feedback loop and you're giving that information to the residency director or the program director so that not just infection control is looking at the measures of success. Evaluation of implementation efforts are important, and again, I'm not going to go through these last several additional steps, but these are all about the end of the RCA, which is around process improvement, communicating your results, and continuing to plan to monitor the results. So if you go through the last steps of the RCA, I've provided another algorithm at the end of your slides, and this is the Barnes-Jewish Hospital Patient Safety Event Review Process. And it just shows you that we get information from lots of different groups. We get information from risk management, and they're usually people that are overseeing incident reports. The infection control professionals have a lot of information. The complaint management database and people doing environment of care rounds all feed information into our reporting system at Barnes-Jewish Hospital. And we have an event review committee, which is a subcommittee of the Patient Safety and Quality Committee, and that's patient safety and risk management staff that really look at, and they have the responsibility for making the determination if something is or isn't a sentinel event. So in our hospital, the infection control professional never makes this call alone, but they actually go through our process and through our event review committee. And they first utilize the infection control work group to determine whether or not this is a suspected sentinel event. But the final call is made after the event review committee makes a decision, and then they get together and they start to formulate and pull together the team that will do the root cause analysis. The next slide in your handout is just what I'll call a crosswalk, and it shows that the steps in Focus PDCA, which is a performance improvement methodology, the steps in the RCA, which are in the middle of the slide, and then on the far right-hand side of the slide are all of the steps in outbreak investigation. And actually, you can take all the steps in a sentinel event and actually do a crosswalk or draw a line to all of the similar steps in outbreak investigation that we do. So the bottom line message for this is that ICPs are experts at some of this stuff. We just call it a different thing, and it has a different name. And there's some required paperwork that has to be filled out. And when you get together to do a root cause analysis, it does take several meetings and a very strong performance improvement facilitator, but you'll bring a lot of good information to the table around standards for infection prevention, knowledge of what the baseline rates are in a hospital, how much training you do of the staff, and whether people in certain areas do or don't comply with our standards for preventing infection. The last couple of slides include some resources that you can go to look at root cause analysis and sentinel events. There are patient safety websites that I've included on here. And then finally, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, or the IHI, is another wonderful place to go to. And their website is there, www.qualityhealthcare.org. They have a whole section on sentinel event investigation, failure modes and effects analysis, how to do an RCA. So there's lots and lots of information out there for ICPs to use, but I think it's really important that you get the experts in your organization to the table with you to make the determination if something's a sentinel event, and then finally to figure out how they will pull a root cause analysis team together and what your role on that team will be. Thank you so much for listening. I know that this is a tremendous amount of information to cover. I'm very happy through Paul to answer some questions that you might have, and we can certainly do a lot of that via email if possible.
Thank you very much, Denise. That was a fabulous presentation. It's an amazing amount of information. You covered it all in the time we had available. Thank you very much. Very well done. It has been my pleasure to host this teleclass today. I would like to thank you all for joining. Thanks again to you, Denise, for your presentation. We sure appreciate all of the effort you put into it. And until we meet again, folks, goodbye.